people who all live somewhere in the United States were using Herb Kovacs credit card accounts to bet on the internet. Yes, I said, and to play online poker. I found some Money Home receipts that show Herb collected large amounts of cash during the week before he died. I believe that cash was to pay off some of the credit card debts.
And are you telling me this has something to do with why he was killed?
Not necessarily, I said. I've no idea why he was killed. I thought that was your job.
He didn't rise to my bait. There was just silence from his end.
I've been trying to cancel the credit cards, I said finally, but they all need an original death certificate. Can you get me some?
I'll need at least 22.
No death certificate has been issued as yet, he said. All unnatural deaths are subject to an inquest, and that will usually follow any criminal trial. The death certificate would be issued only after the inquest was complete.
But that will be months, if not years away, I said, with a degree of exasperation. There must be some official piece of paper that shows that he's dead. I need something to show the damn credit card companies.
As his executor, you can apply for probate before the death certificate is issued.
How? I said, I've got nothing to show he's even dead.
The inquest was opened and adjourned last Tuesday, he said. The Liverpool coroner will issue you with a letter.
I'll arrange it.
Thank you.
So, where can I find Mr. Kovacs' sister? The chief inspector asked.
At his flat, I think. She was there on Friday afternoon.
Right, he said. Did she know her brother was murdered?
Yes, I said, I told her.
Good. I'll be in touch so she can make an official identification.
Poor girl, I thought.
Anything else?
Yes, I said. Have you any idea who killed him?
Not as yet, he said.
Any leads at all?
No, none. The gunman seems to have disappeared completely.
At least he was honest.
How about the note I found in Herb's coat pocket? I asked.
Nothing to go on, he said. The paper was just common copy paper available from any stationer or office supply store, and the only discernible fingerprints were either yours or Mr. Kovacs'.
How could you tell? I asked.
We checked yours against the sample set you gave me, and I arranged for Mr. Kovacs to be taken from his body.
I wished I hadn't asked.
So where do you go from here?
Think I'd better take another look at those lists, he said, and I want to see those Money Home receipts. I'll arrange to have them collected from your office.
I may not be in the office this week, I said. Can you collect them from my home?
I thought for a moment.
In fact, I have two receipts here, but the three from last week are still at Herb's flat.
I may need to go and see Mr. Kovacs' sister. I'll call you back later when I know my movements.
Sherry, I said.
What?
Sherry, I repeated. Sherry Kovac, Herb's sister? They were twins.
Oh, he said. Somehow being twins made it worse.
Claudia and I went out to dinner at Luigi's, a local Italian restaurant, and managed to spend the whole meal talking without once mentioning the C-word. We both skirted around it on purpose, like a game. But it did mean we discussed all sorts of other things, many of which we had bottled up over the past couple of weeks.
My mother sends her love, I said.
Oh, thanks, Claudia replied. How is she?
I wanted to say she was in need of grandchildren, but I didn't.
My mother would have to take her chances on Tuesday with a surgeon's knife like the rest of us. Fine, I said. She loves her little cottage and she's been busy with the local village historical society.
Perhaps we can go down and see her together, Claudia said.
After.
After the operation, she meant.
I'd better call Jan Setter in the morning and tell her we won't be able to make the opening night on Wednesday.
You can go on your own, Claudia said. You'll enjoy it.
Sitting next to Jan in the theatre all evening with her hands wandering all over me in the darkness?
No, thanks.
No, I said. I'll tell her that neither of us will be there.
Claudia smiled at me. I knew it was what she really wanted.
It saved me buying a new dress anyway.
We laughed.
That was the closest we came all evening to discussing her operation, and presently I paid the bill and took my girl home to bed. She had to go into the hospital the following evening, ready for the surgery on the Tuesday morning. Hence our lovemaking was passionate and full on, as if we both realized that this might be our last time together, with Claudia as a fertile woman.
Chapter 11. At 9 a.m. sharp on Monday morning, I called Patrick in the office.
Am I forgiven yet? I asked him.
"Gregory's not here today," he replied. "He's been away for the weekend and isn't back until tomorrow afternoon or Wednesday. I think it best if you stay away a while longer."
I wasn't going to argue. Not having to be in the office over the next couple of days suited me very well.
"Can I now use the remote access facility?" I asked, "just to check that I'm not missing something that should be done today."
The system allowed us to attach reminder notices to client files, for example, to alert us to a maturing bond or a rights issue, so that we didn't miss an opportunity to invest the client's money most favourably.
"Of course," Patrick replied.
Things had clearly mellowed over the weekend.
"So shall I plan on being in again on Wednesday?" I asked.
"Thursday might be better," Patrick said, seemingly a little undecided. "I'll speak to Gregory over lunch on Wednesday."
"Thursday it is, then," I said,
"unless I hear from you sooner."
"Right," Patrick seemed rather distracted.
"There is a bit of a backlog with both you and Herb not being here. Diana and Rory will just have to cover everything until Thursday. I'll ask them to stay late."
I smiled. I bet Rory wouldn't like that. There was no extra money for doing overtime in our job.
Detective Chief Inspector Tomlinson had called on Sunday evening to say he was travelling down from Liverpool and to ask if I could meet him at Herb Kovacs' flat at 11 the following morning. Yes, I'd said, I could. In the end, both Claudia and I went over to Hendon together in the Mercedes because she didn't want to be left alone, and I was delighted to have her with me. The policeman was there ahead of us, and he had been interviewing poor Sherry Kovac, who was clearly distressed by the experience. Her eyes were red from crying, and she looked pale and drawn. Claudia went immediately and put her arm round Sherry's shoulders, even before they were introduced, taking her off into the kitchen.
"Thank you for coming," the chief inspector said to me, shaking my hand. "I'm sorry, but I seem to have rather upset Miss Kovac."
"How?" I asked.
"I told her that I needed her to come back with me to Liverpool to carry out a formal identification of the body."
I nodded. "I feared you might."
"You would think it wouldn't be necessary to put people through such emotional trauma.
Especially, I thought, as one of the bullets that had killed him had entered through his face."
"I'm afraid the law takes little notice of people's feelings."
"And you should know," I said.
"Yes," he said, looking me in the eye. "I certainly do."
Claudia came back out into the hallway, and I introduced her properly to Detective Chief Inspector Tomlinson.
"So, are you the man who arrested my Nick?" she asked accusingly.
"No, darling," I said, springing quickly to the policeman's defence. "This isn't the man who arrested me. This is the one who provided me with an alibi."
"Oh," she said. "All right, then, you may live."
The chief inspector smiled at her little joke, but he was there strictly on business.
"Now," he said to me, getting down to it, "where are these money home receipts?"
Claudia went back to Sherry in the kitchen while the chief inspector and I went through into the living room. I spread out the stuck-together little squares on Herb's desk. The chief inspector's eyebrows rose a notch.
"I found them torn up like this in the waste bin," I said. "I stuck them together. There are three different payment slips here, one for $8,000 and two for $5,000 each." "And you say that Mr. Kovac collected this money from a money home agent during the week before he was killed?"
"Yes," I said. "That's according to the stamps on them."
"And do you know who sent him the money?"
"No," I replied. "Money Home apparently only require the recipient's name and something called the money transfer control number in order to pay out. The agent doesn't seem to know the sender's name."
"These bloody money transfer companies," he said. "They seem to be absolutely determined to allow people to transfer money around the world completely anonymously. Cash in, cash out, no questions asked. They make it so easy for the villains, especially the drug dealers."
"Can't you make them tell you who sent the money?" I asked.
"They probably don't know themselves," he said. "And if they do get a name, it's probably false."
"Butch Cassidy," I said.
"Hey?"
"The recipient names on the payment slips," I said. I added the two from my pocket to the three on the desk. Butch Cassidy, Billy Kidd, Wyatt Earp, Jesse James, and Bill Cody. It's not very difficult to spot their false.
"Were they the aliases used by Mr. Kovac when he collected the money?" he asked, studying the slips.
"Yes," I said. I could see from his expression that the chief inspector immediately cast Herb as one of his villains.
"He wasn't a drug dealer," I said.
The chief inspector looked up at me.
"And he wasn't a crook. He was just allowing his fellow Americans to do what we in England can do quite legitimately every day." Gambling is a mug's game, he said. As may be, I agreed, but it's legal, taxed, and without it, there probably wouldn't be any horse racing, certainly not the industry we have today.
The policeman pursed his lips as if to say he didn't think it would be a great loss. I wondered if all policemen were born puritanical, or did it develop after several years in the job?
Mr. Kovac was still breaking the law.
Was he? I asked. Whose law?
He was aiding and abetting others,
the chief inspector said with certainty.
I wasn't going to argue with him. I was pretty certain myself that if the reports of the arrest of the CEO of the internet gambling site was anything to go by, Herb would have faced racketeering charges in the United States if they had known what he was up to. I also showed the chief inspector the stack of unsigned credit cards, but he seemed far more interested in the money home payment slips.
So, where do we go from here? I asked.
I will take these slips and try to get money home to at least divulge which of their offices the money was sent from. The transfer number should be enough to do that. Then, we will have to painstakingly try to find out whose initials are on the sheets of paper.
You really think this must have something to do with Herb's murder? I asked.
Don't you? He said. We've no other leads to go on. You never know. Perhaps Mr. Kovac was blackmailing one of his clients, threatening to tell the U.S. authorities about their illegal gambling, so they killed him.
There goes that suspicious mind of yours again, Chief Inspector.
Suspicion is all we have at the moment, he said seriously, and there's precious little of that in this case.
There was a heavy knock at the front door.
That would be my sergeant, the Chief Inspector said. He's come to drive Miss Kovac and me to Liverpool.
Claudia and I
watched them go.
That poor girl, Claudia said, holding my hand. Her family are all dead. She's alone in the world.
At least she's healthy, I thought.
How typical of my gorgeous Claudia to think of others when she had enough of her own troubles to worry about.
Do you fancy going out to lunch? I asked.
Lovely, she said. Luigi's again? It's a bit unimaginative, she said.
But why not? I like it there.
I drove us home, and we again walked around the corner to our favourite restaurant. On this occasion, the proprietor, Luigi Puccinelli, was present.
Ah, Signor Foxtone, and the lovely Signorina Claudia. Buongiorno, welcome, he said, being his usual effusive self. Table for two? Bene. Follow me.
He showed us to our favourite table in the window.
We don't often see you for lunch, Luigi said in his Italian accent, adding an eh to every word that ended in a consonant.
No, I said, it's a special treat.
Eccellente, he said with a flourish, giving us the menus.
Grazie, I said to him, playing the game.
Luigi was no more Italian than I was. I'd met his mother one night in the restaurant, and she had told me with a laugh that Luigi Puccinelli had been born Jim Metcalf in a nursing home up the Tottenham High Road, not 5 miles away. But good luck to him, I thought. The food and service at Luigi's were superb, and his restaurant thrived, authentic Italian or not. Claudia chose the antipasto for us to share as a starter, with saltimbocca all'apollo to follow, while I decided on the risotto al funghi. We ate the antipasto in silence.
Speak to me, Claudia said. This is not the last meal of the condemned, you know.
I smiled at her.
No, of course not.
But we were both nervous. Nervous of what tomorrow morning would bring. I ordered a taxi to take us to the hospital that evening at 7 o'clock.
Why do you need to go in the night before? I asked Claudia as we made our way down the Finchley Road.
Something about wanting to monitor me overnight before the operation so they have something to compare the readings with afterwards.
What time is the op in the morning? I asked.
The surgeon said it would be first thing, just as soon as he's finished his early morning rounds.
That meant it could be any time, I thought. In my experience, and I had plenty of it from my racing days, doctors and surgeons were about as good at timekeeping as a London bus in the rush hour.
At least we won't have to wait all day, I said, smiling at her. She gave me a look that said she would be quite happy to wait all year.
It's better to get it done, and then at least we will know what we're up against.
I know, she said, but I'm frightened.
So was I, but now is not the time to show it.
Everything will be okay, I said, trying to sound reassuring. You said they found it early? And I've researched everything on the internet. You're going to be just fine. You'll see. Oh, Nick, she said, grasping my hand very tight. There were tears in her eyes. I pulled her close to me and we sat in silence as the taxi maneuvered through Regent's Park and out onto the Euston Road. It was a difficult evening and night for both of us. Claudia was checked into the hospital by the admission staff, for whom it was a regular routine to be completed with brisk efficiency. They didn't mean to be uncaring, but quite a few times they made us feel uncomfortable and even foolish. I kept having to wait in the corridor outside her room as nurses and technicians came to perform some action or other. Swabs were taken from inside Claudia's nose and mouth, and others were then taken from more intimate areas. Blood was drawn for this, and urine was tested for that. After a couple of hours, they finally said that she was ready for the morning, and they left us in peace. I turned off the bright overhead lights and dimmed the reading light to a much more subdued level. Suddenly, everything did not look quite so stark and antiseptic. Much better. I sat on a chair by her bed and held her hand. You ought to go home, Claudia said. I'll be fine. Unless they physically throw me out, I said, I'm not going anywhere. Claudia laid her head back on the pillow and smiled. Good, she said. I still couldn't believe how badly I had read the situation between us. What a fool I had been, and what a greater fool I might have become. Just thinking about it brought me out in a cold sweat. You get some sleep now, my love, I said to her. You'll need all the strength you can get for tomorrow. This bloody bed is so hard it makes my back ache. I spent a few minutes using the electric bed control, lifting the head or feet, trying to make her more comfortable. It didn't really work. Why can't they have bloody beds that are comfortable to lie on? Claudia complained. You think that would be the first priority? I recognized what was happening. She was getting irritated by the slightest little thing. It was the sign of the nervous condition she was in. I would just have to smile gently and agree with her. Yes, darling, I said. Please try and close your eyes and get some rest. You try resting on this bloody thing, she snapped, turning herself over once again to face away from me. In the end, she settled, and in time, I could tell from the sound of her breathing that she was asleep. I settled down into the chair and closed my eyes. One of the nurses came into the room and snapped on the overhead lights. Time for your vitals, she said loudly. And so it went on through the night, with temperature, pulse, and blood pressure being measured at 2 hourly intervals. Each time accompanied by the Blackpool illuminations. Hospitals were clearly never designed for relaxation and recovery. No one told me to go home, so I didn't, although I had to admit, it was not the best night's sleep I'd ever had. Breakfast wasn't eaten by Claudia, or even offered, there being a large nil-by-mouth sign hanging on a hook by the door, so I went down to the hospital lobby at about 6 a.m. in search of a coffee and a bun for myself, while the patient had a shower. At about 8:30, Mr. Tomic, the surgeon, arrived wearing light blue scrub tunic and trousers, all set for the operating theatre. He brought with him some paperwork and a thick permanent marker pen, which he used to draw a big black arrow on the left side of Claudia below her belly button. Don't want to take out the wrong one now, do we? He said. It somehow wasn't very encouraging. What exactly are you going to do? I asked. I will make 2 small incisions here and here. He pointed to each side of Claudia's lower abdomen. I will then use a laparoscope to have a good look at all her bits, and then I'll remove the left ovary completely, he said. I also plan to take a wedge biopsy of the right ovary. And what is a wedge biopsy exactly? I asked. A small sample that is removed like a tiny bite, which is then tested to see if it's clear, he said. Then I will sew everything up, and Claudia will be back here before you know it, about 2 hours in total, maybe a fraction more. And if the biopsy's not clear? Claudia asked. If I can tell that straight away just by looking, the surgeon said, then I'll have to remove that ovary as well. Otherwise, the biopsy will be sent to the lab for tests. There is a slight chance that I may also need to perform a complete hysterectomy if I find cancer cells attached to the uterus, but I think from the scans that that will be most unlikely. Claudia looked at me with rising panic in her eyes. Mr. Tomic spotted it. Claudia, he said, I promise you I will do as little as possible. But we have to deal with this. It won't go away on its own. I have to tell you everything that might happen because I need your consent to proceed. You will understand that I can't wake you up halfway through the operation to ask your permission to remove your womb if I need to do it in order to save your life. He smiled at her. But I really don't think it will come to that.
Can't you just remove the tumor? I asked. Do you have to take out the whole ovary?
The tumor will probably have taken over most of the ovary, and it is the only way of ensuring it doesn't return.
If the second ovary is clear, does that mean it will remain so? I asked.
Let's cross one bridge at a time, he said. We'll discuss the future after the operation. I took that to mean no, it probably wouldn't remain clear. My mother's wish for grandchildren was not looking too promising.
Right then, said Mr. Tomic.
I need you to sign here, he pointed, and here, and here.
Claudia looked at me in despair. I pursed my lips and nodded at her. She signed the papers.
What choice did we have?
Okay, said the surgeon, taking back the forms from her.
I'll see you in theatre in about 20 minutes.
Wait here, they'll come for you.
I wanted to tell him to be careful with my girl, but I didn't. Of course he'd be careful.
Wouldn't he?
If the previous evening had been bad, the next 20 minutes were intolerable. Mr. Tomic had left the door open, and every time someone walked down the corridor outside, we both jumped. What was there to say? Nothing. We both just watched the clock on the wall move inexorably round from 8:50 to 9 o'clock, then ever onwards to 9:05. And 9:10. Claudia held onto my hand as if her life depended on it.
It'll be all right, I said. You heard what he said. You'll be back in here before you know it.
Oh, Nick, she said miserably. If I come out of this with only a tiny piece of an ovary left, let's use it to have kids.
Okay, I said. You're on.
Marry me first, she asked.
You bet, I said.
It was an unusual proposal, but we were in an unusual situation. At 9:15, a theatre porter arrived wearing blue scrubs and a J-cloth hat.
Please be careful with my fiancée, I said to him as he wheeled her bed out of the room into the corridor. She's very precious to me.
I went with her to the lift, where the porter said he was sorry, but I couldn't come any further. I looked at Claudia's frightened face until the closing lift doors cut off our line of sight, and all too quickly she was gone. I went back into her room and sat down on the chair. Never before had I felt so desperate, so helpless, and alone. In truth, it was not a great start to an engagement.
Claudia didn't come back for nearly 3 hours. By which time I was almost crawling up the walls of her room with worry. Sitting alone in that hospital room had been far worse than spending 3 times as long in a cell at Paddington Green Police Station. I spent some time going over in my mind what must be happening downstairs in the operating theatre, mentally carving up the clock face into segments. First, I tried to imagine how long it would take for Claudia to be put to sleep, then how long to make the incision in her body, next, how long to remove the ovary, and so on. I had no idea if I was right or not, or even if I was close, but it seemed to help. My mental calculations, however, had her coming back to the room in 2 hours, and when she didn't, my imagination went into overdrive, envisaging all sorts of horrors, while the clock on the wall went on ticking as if mocking me, and still Claudia didn't return. By the time I finally heard her being wheeled back along the corridor, I had convinced myself that the whole thing had gone horribly wrong and Claudia had died on the operating table. But she wasn't dead, she was just cold and shivering uncontrollably. I was so pleased to see her, but she was not a happy bunny, not at all. She was sore from the surgery and feeling nauseous from the anaesthetic, and she couldn't stop the shivering.
It's quite normal, said a nurse curtly when I asked about it. She'll be fine soon.
Can she please have another blanket? I asked. Reluctantly, she agreed, and in time, the shivering did abate, and Claudia relaxed
and eventually she went to sleep. Mr. Tomic came to see us at about 2 o'clock while Claudia was still sleeping.
"I have some good news and not quite such good news," he said to me quietly. "Firstly, the good news is that I removed only one ovary, and the other one looked perfectly fine, although I took a piece for a biopsy and it's currently being assessed in the path lab."
"And the not-so-good news?" I asked.
"The tumour was not quite fully contained in the ovary as we had thought, and it had erupted on the surface. It's often difficult to tell precisely from the scans."
"And what exactly does that mean?" I said.
"It means there is every likelihood that there will be some ovarian cancer cells present in the fluid within the abdominal cavity. We will know for sure when the lab tests are complete."
"And?" I said.
"In order to be sure we've killed off the cancer completely, I think a course or two of chemo will probably be needed."
"Chemotherapy?" I said.
"I'm afraid so," he replied, "just to be sure."
"Does that mean I'll lose my hair?" Claudia asked. Her eyes were closed, and I hadn't realized she'd been awake and listening.
"It might," he said, "although the drugs are much better than they used to be." I took that to mean, yes, she would lose her hair. "But even so, it will grow back." Claudia's long, flowing, jet-black hair was her pride and joy.
"Does the chemo start straight away?" I asked.
"Within a few weeks," he said. "We'll give Claudia time to recover from the surgery first."
"Will it affect the other ovary?" I asked. "I read on the internet that some cancer drugs make women infertile."
"The drugs used are very powerful," he said. "They work by attacking cells that divide rapidly, like cancer cells, but they do tend to affect everything in the body to some degree. Am I to assume that preserving fertility is a priority?"
"Yes," said Claudia unequivocally, still not opening her eyes.
"Then we will just have to be very careful," he said. "Won't we?"
At 3:30 in the afternoon, I left Claudia resting in the hospital while I went home to change and have a shower, taking the Northern Line tube from Warren Street to Finchley Central. "I won't be long," I told her. "About an hour and a half."
"Is there anything I can get you?"
"A new body," she said miserably.
"I love the one you have," I said, and she forced a smile.
The doctor had told us that she would have to stay in hospital for another night, but she should be able to go home the following day, or on Thursday at the latest. The sun was shining as the tube train rose from the dark tunnels into the daylight just before East Finchley Station. It was always a welcome sign. It meant I was nearly home. As I walked down Lichfield Grove, I could see that there was a man standing outside my house with his finger on the doorbell. I was about to call out to him when he turned his head slightly, as if looking over his shoulder. In spite of telling the police that I hadn't seen Herb's killer at Aintree, I knew him instantly. Here he was, standing outside my front door in Finchley, and I didn't think he was visiting to inquire after my health. My heartbeat at once jumped to stratospheric proportions, and I stifled the shout that was already rising in my throat. I started to turn away from him, but not before our eyes had made contact, and I had glimpsed the long black shape in his right hand, his trusty gun, complete with silencer. "Bugger," I thought. I turned and ran as fast as I could back up Lichfield Grove towards Regent's Park Road. Lichfield Grove may have been used as a busy shortcut during the rush hour, but it was sleepy and deserted at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, with not even any schoolchildren on their way home. Safety, I thought, would be where there were lots of people. Surely he wouldn't kill me with witnesses. But he had killed Herb with over 60,000 of them. I chanced to glance back, having to turn my upper body due to the restricted movement of my neck. It was a mistake. The gunman was still behind me, only about 30 yards away, running hard and lifting his right arm to aim. I heard a bullet whiz past me on my left. I ran harder, and also I started shouting, "Help! Help!" I shouted as loudly as my heaving lungs would allow. "Call the police!" No one shouted back, and I needed the air for my aching leg muscles. Oh, to be as fit as I once was as a jockey. I thought I heard another bullet fly past me and zing off the pavement ahead as a ricochet, but I wasn't stopping to check. I made it unharmed to Regent's Park Road and went left round the corner. Without breaking stride, I went straight into Mr. Patel's news agency, pushing past the startled owner and crouched down under his counter, gasping for air. "Mr. Patel," I said, "I am being chased. Please call the police." I didn't know why. Perhaps it was because of his cultural background, but he didn't become angry or question why I had invaded his space. He simply stood quietly and looked down at me, as if in slight surprise at the strange behaviour of the English. "Mr. Patel," I said, again with urgency, still breathing hard, "I am being chased by a very dangerous man. Please, do not look down at me, or he will know that I am here. Please, call the police."
"What man?" he said, still looking down at me.
"The man outside the window," I said.
Mr. Patel looked up.
Suddenly I remembered that I had my mobile in my pocket. As I dialed 999, I heard the shop door being opened, the little bell ringing once. I held my breath. I could feel my heart going thump, thump in my chest.
"Emergency? Which service?" said a voice from my phone.
I stuffed the phone into my armpit, hoping that the newcomer into the shop hadn't heard it.
"Yes," said Mr. Patel. "Can I help you, sir?"
The newcomer made no reply, and I went on holding my breath, my chest feeling like it was going to burst.
"Can I help you, sir?"
Mr. Patel said again, but more loudly. Again there was no reply. All I could hear were faint footsteps. I just had to breathe, so I let the air out through my mouth as quietly as I could and took another deep breath in. I wished I could see what was happening in the shop. After a few seconds, I heard the door close, ringing the bell once again. But was the gunman on the inside or the outside? Mr. Patel stood stock still above me, giving me no indication either way.
"He has gone outside," he said finally, without changing his position.
"What's he doing?" I asked.
"He is standing and looking around," Mr. Patel said. "Who is he and why is he chasing you? Are you a criminal?"
"No," I said, "I am not."
I remembered the phone under my arm. The operator had obviously got fed up waiting and had hung up. I dialed 999 again.
"Emergency, which service?" said a voice again.
"Police," I said.
"Police incident room, go ahead," said another voice.
"There's an armed gunman in the street on Regent's Park Road in Finchley," I said quickly.
Mr. Patel looked down at me.
"Mr. Patel," I said urgently, "please do not look down. The man might see you and come back into the shop."
"What number, Regent's Park Road?" said the voice on the phone.
"Near the corner of Litchfield Grove," I said. "Please hurry."
"Your name, sir?" said the voice.
"Foxton," I said into the phone. "Mr. Patel, what is the man doing now?"
"He is walking away."
"No!
He has stopped. He is looking back. Oh, goodness gracious, he is coming back this way."
Mr. Patel leaned down, grabbed some keys from a hook under the counter and walked out of my sight. "What are you doing?" I called after him urgently.
"Locking the door," he said.
I didn't have time to think whether it was a good idea or not before I heard Mr. Patel turn the key in the lock. Now the gunman would be sure where I was, and I could hear the door being shaken.
"Mr. Patel," I shouted, "get away from the door. The man has a gun." "It is all right, Mr. Foxton," he said with a laugh. "It is not him shaking the door. It is me.
The man has gone past.
I cannot see him any more."
It didn't mean he wasn't there, so I stayed exactly where I was. My heart rate may have come down a few notches, but as far as I was concerned, it was still no laughing matter.
"Now, Mr. Foxton, why is a man with a gun chasing you? It is like a film, no?"
"No," I said. "This was very real life. He was trying to kill me."
"But why?" he said.
It was a good question. A very good question. I remained sitting on the floor behind Mr. Patel's counter until the police arrived. It took them nearly 40 minutes, and I had telephoned 999 again twice more before two heavily armed and body-armoured officers finally made an appearance at the shop door. Mr. Patel let them in.
"About time, too," I said, standing up from my hiding place.
"Mr. Foxton,"
one of the officers asked, his machine pistol held at the ready position with his finger over the trigger.
"Yes," I said, "that's me. Are you armed, sir?"
"No," I said.
"Please put your hands on your head," he said, pointing his gun towards me.
"It's not me who's the gunman," I said, slightly irritated. "It was the man who was chasing me."
"Put your hands on your head," the policeman repeated with a degree of menace. "And you, sir," he said, pointing his gun briefly towards Mr. Patel.
We both put our hands on our heads. Mr. Patel smiled broadly, as if he thought the whole thing was a huge joke. The second officer came forward and searched me, making sure he didn't get between my chest and the muzzle of his colleague's weapon. He then did likewise to Mr. Patel. Then he went through the shop and out of sight through a plastic curtain into the room behind. He soon reappeared, shaking his head. Only then did they relax a little.
"Sorry about that, sir," said the first officer, securing his gun across his chest with a strap. "We can't be too careful."
I put my arms down. What took you so long to get here?
We had to seal off the whole area, he said. Standard practice when there's a report of a gunman.
He put his finger to his ear, clearly listening to someone on his personal radio earpiece.
Now, sir, he said to me, my superintendent wants to know if you have a description of this gunman.
His tone suggested that he didn't altogether believe that a gunman had been stalking the streets of Finchley on a sleepy Tuesday afternoon in late April. I think I may have better than that, I said. Mr. Patel, does your closed-circuit TV system have a recorder? I had passed some of my time waiting for the police by looking up at the small white video camera situated above the racks of cigarettes.
Of course, Mr. Patel replied. I need to have it to catch the young scoundrels who steal my stock.
Then, officer, I said, please would you kindly inform Detective Chief Inspector Tomlinson of the Merseyside Police that we have the murderer of Herb Kovac caught on video? But how had he known where to find me? And why?
Chapter 12. In the end, it was I who rang Chief Inspector Tomlinson, but not before the armed response team had completed a full debrief of the events in Finchley.
So, you say you saw a man standing outside your front door? Asked the response team superintendent as we stood in Mr. Patel's shop.
Yes, I said, he was ringing the doorbell, and he had a gun. Yes, I said again, with a silencer. There was something about his demeanour that said that he too didn't really believe me. Mr. Patel hadn't seen any gun, nor, it seemed, had anyone else.
He shot at me, I said, as I ran up Litchfield Grove. He shot at least twice. I heard the bullets whiz past my head.
A team was dispatched to search, and in due course, one of them returned with two empty brass cases in a plastic bag. Suddenly, everything became more serious. They believed me now.
You'll have to come to the police station, said the superintendent, to give a statement.
Can't I do it here? I asked.
I need to reopen my shop, said Mr. Patel anxiously.
At my house, then? I asked. I need to get back to University College Hospital. My girlfriend had an operation this morning and she's expecting me.
Reluctantly, the superintendent agreed to do it at my house, and we walked down Litchfield Grove together. The road had been closed to traffic, and about a dozen police officers in dark blue boiler suits were moving up the road in line abreast, crawling on all fours.
Looking for the bullets, the superintendent informed me before I asked. Don't touch the door, he said as we arrived at my house, or the doorbell.
I carefully opened the door with my key, and we went into the kitchen.
Now, Mr. Foxton, the superintendent said formally, tell me why a gunman would come calling at your front door.
It was the question I'd been asking myself for the past hour.
I'm sure he was here to kill me, I said.
That's very dramatic. Why?
Why indeed? When he could have done it so easily at Aintree at the same time as he killed Herb. What, I wondered, had changed in the intervening 10 days that meant I needed to be killed now but hadn't needed to be then? I told the superintendent all about the murder at the Grand National, and it was then that I again suggested calling DCI Tomlinson.
My goodness, Mr. Foxton, the chief inspector said down the wire with a laugh. You seem to be making a habit of being interviewed by the police.
I can assure you it's a habit I intend to give up at the earliest opportunity, I replied. The two senior policemen then spoke together for some time, and it was frustrating for me listening to only one half of the conversation. Mostly they spoke about the videotape that the superintendent had removed from Mr. Patel's recorder. The superintendent and I had watched it on the small black-and-white screen in the storeroom behind the shop. Just seeing the grainy image of the man as he had come through the shop door made the hairs on the back of my neck stand upright. He had advanced a couple of paces in and stood there looking around. Then he had walked down the length of the shop, putting his head through the plastic curtain into the storeroom behind. He then retraced his steps and went out of the door, closing it behind him. Unfortunately, the angle of the CCTV camera didn't show what he did next, and none of the images showed his gun, which he must have been holding in his anorak pocket. I shivered. How close had I come to hiding in the back room? Very close.
Chief Inspector Tomlinson would like another word, the superintendent said to me finally, handing over the phone.
Yes, I said.
Can you think of any reason why someone would want you killed?
No, I can't, I said. And if they did, why wait until now? Why not do it at Aintree at the same time as killing Herb Kovac? Something must have changed since then.
But what, he said, have you been trying to find out whose initials are on those sheets?
No, I haven't. I did go into a money home agent and ask about the payslips, but that was last Friday.
Leave the investigating to the professionals, Mr. Foxton, said the chief inspector somewhat formally. I think I was being told off.
But if I hadn't, I said in my defence, then you wouldn't know that it was other Americans who were gambling using Mr. Kovac's credit cards.
We still don't know that for certain, he said. Maybe not, I thought, but I was sure I was right.
So how are you going to catch this guy, I asked him, and before he succeeds in killing me?
Superintendent Yearing will issue an immediate alert to all stations, including the airports and ports, with the man's image from the tape. And we will be approaching the TV stations to run the video clip in their news broadcasts.
It didn't sound sufficiently proactive to me.
Haven't you got some mugshots or something for me to look at, I asked. I have to tell you, I don't feel very safe with this guy still out there on the loose.
You had better ask Superintendent Yearing, he said.
So I did. But he wasn't very forthcoming.
We have literally tens of thousands of mugshots, he said. It would take you weeks to look through them all, and our man may not even be there.
We need something else to point us in the right direction first. Then it might be worthwhile. Perhaps we'll get a fingerprint from your doorbell. Be patient, Mr. Foxton. The video image is good, and it should bear dividends when it's shown on the news.
If I lived that long, I thought.
Can't you provide me with some police protection, I asked, in a safe house or something?
MI5 might have safe houses, but we don't, he said with a smile. You've been watching too much TV.
But someone is trying to kill me, I said in frustration. Surely it's your job to prevent that. I need some protection.
I'm sorry, he said. We simply don't have the manpower.
They had the manpower, I thought, to have a dozen officers crawl along the road on their hands and knees looking for a bullet, but not enough to prevent a future murder. It was crazy.
So what am I to do? I asked him. Just sit here and wait to be killed?
Perhaps it wouldn't be sensible to stay here, he conceded. Have you anywhere else to go to?
My home and my office were now off limits. Where else?
I'm going back to the hospital to see my girlfriend, I said.
Some of the armed response team agreed to wait in my house while I belatedly had a shower and changed my clothes. I then threw some things into a suitcase, including my computer, and set off for the hospital in the back of one of their police vans.
It's the least we can do, I said.
At one point, I insisted that the police driver go right round the big roundabout at Swiss Cottage to make sure we were not being followed. We weren't, of course. What sort of killer would follow a van full of heavily armed police? But what sort of killer would gun a man down with 60,000 witnesses close to hand? Or try to kill someone on their own front doorstep? I couldn't help but think of Jill Dando, the British TV personality, gunned down in exactly that way in a Fulham street. And her killer has never been identified. Claudia was still resting when I made it back to her room in the hospital. She was neither aware nor surprised that I had been away for nearly 4 hours, and not the 1.5 I'd promised. I had made it unmolested and alive from the police van outside the hospital main door to her room, but not without a nervous glance at every person I met on the way. I nearly had heart failure when, just as the lift doors were closing, a man jumped through the gap who slightly resembled my would-be killer. If I went on like this, I'd be a nervous wreck in no time. I closed the door to Claudia's room, but of course there was no lock on the inside. It made me feel very uneasy. I thought it unlikely that the gunman would give up just because he'd lost me once. I imagined he was a professional assassin, and like most professionals, he would take pride in completing his job. Bugger the police, I thought. I felt so vulnerable. I believed absolutely that I needed some protection or else I'd wind up dead. Maybe I might be killed even if I had a bodyguard, but at least it would make me feel a little safer. However, Mrs. Gandhi, the Indian Prime Minister, had been shot dead by one of her bodyguards, so armed protection wasn't always the best policy. What should I do? I couldn't hide forever. But what was the alternative? Perhaps I should buy a bulletproof vest. My main objective had to be to find out who was trying to have me killed and stop them, or at least remove the need, as they saw it, for my life to be terminated. Easy. But why would anyone want me dead? It seemed a very extreme solution to any problem. I must know something, or have something, that someone didn't want me to tell or show to somebody else. Hence, I needed to be killed to prevent it. So what was it that I had or knew? The police already had the credit card statements and the money home payment slips, so surely it couldn't be them. Was there something else I had inherited from Herb that was so incriminating that murder was the only answer? Claudia groaned a little and woke up. Hello, my darling, I said. How are you feeling?
bloody awful, she said, and really thirsty.
I poured some water from the jug on her bedside cabinet into a plastic glass and held it out to her. Just go easy, I said. The nurse said to drink just small sips. She drank several large ones and then handed back the glass.
I feel so sore and bloated, she said.
Mr. Tomic said you might. It'll pass in a day or so. She didn't seem much reassured.
Can you help me sit up a bit, she asked. I'm so uncomfortable in this bloody bed.
I did as she asked, but it didn't really improve matters. Nothing would, I realized, for as long as she was in pain. Let's get you some painkillers, I said, and pushed the nurse call bell. They gave her an injection of morphine that deadened the pain, but also sent Claudia back to sleep. It was probably the best thing for her. I put on the television to watch the news, but I kept the sound down to a minimum so as not to disturb the patient. The gunman in a London newsagent's was the lead story, and true to their word, the police had convinced the TV company to play the whole video clip of Herb's killer coming into the shop, looking around, and then leaving again. They even showed a blown-up still of the man's face as he had glanced directly up at the camera. Just looking at his image made me nervous once more. The news reporter then warned the viewers not to approach the man if they saw him, but to report his presence to the police. The man is armed and very dangerous, the reporter said, but he didn't mention anything about Herb Kovac or the killing at Aintree. Did the news report and the video make it safer for me or not? I also wondered if it put Mr. Patel at risk. After all, he was the one who had the best view of the gunman. I suddenly went quite cold just thinking about how much mortal danger I had placed Mr. Patel in by hiding behind his counter. But what else could I have done? Stayed out in the street and been killed? I switched over to another channel and watched the whole thing once more, trying my best to recognize the face staring out at me from the screen. I knew I didn't know him, other than at Aintree and in a Finchley street, but I tried to find some semblance or likeness. There was none. Thankfully, Claudia slept soundly through both bulletins. She had enough worries on her own plate for the time being without being burdened with something else. After all, there was nothing she could do about it. While she went on sleeping, I tried to work out where I could spend the night. I wasn't going back to Finchley, that was for sure, but a second night sitting upright in the chair in Claudia's hospital room wasn't a very attractive proposition either. As I still had the key in my pocket, I thought of going to Herb's flat in Hendon, but I didn't want to turn up there late at night frightening Sherry after her traumatic trip to Liverpool. So, instead, I used my phone to find a cheap room near the hospital in a hotel located round the corner in Euston Square Gardens. They had plenty of availability, so I didn't leave my name. I just planned to turn up there when I left the hospital. That somehow seemed safer. One of the nurses came into Claudia's room to take once more her vital signs and to settle her for the night. I took it as my cue to leave. Night-night, my darling, I said. I'll be back in the morning.
What about your job? She said sleepily.
I'll call the office and tell them I'm not coming in, I said. The work will have to wait. She smiled and laid her head back on the pillow. She looked very vulnerable, with her pale face almost matching the slight greyness of the hospital linen. We had to beat this imposter within her body, this cancer that would eat away at her happiness. If chemotherapy was what was needed, so be it. Short-term discomfort for long-term gain, that was what we had to think, what we had to believe. I checked into the hotel using a false name, and I paid for the room in advance with cash that I had drawn from an ATM in Euston Station. As the superintendent had said, I'd probably been watching too much TV, and I didn't really believe for a minute that the gunman had access to my credit card accounts, but I was taking absolutely no chances. I had left the hospital by the main door only because there were no dark, shadowy corners, as there were outside the back entrance, but not before I had stood for a while behind a pillar watching the road, checking for anyone lurking in wait for me with a silenced pistol. And I hadn't left the building alone, but had waited for a group of cleaning staff going off duty. No one had fired a shot or come running after me. But would I even know if they did? I was certain Herb had been dead at Aintree before he realized what was happening. I locked my bedroom door and then propped a chair under the door handle for good measure. I then relaxed a little and ate the takeaway cheeseburger, fries and milkshake that I'd bought from a late-night burger bar in the railway station. It was the first thing I'd eaten all day. My mother would not have been pleased. I removed my computer from my bag and logged onto the internet to check my emails. Amongst the usual bunch from various fund managers wanting me to contact them about their latest investment offering was one from Patrick, expressing his disquiet over recent happenings both inside and outside the office. It hadn't been addressed solely to me, but had been sent to all the Lyle and Black staff, but it felt like I was the main target. "Dear colleagues," Patrick had written, "at this time of seemingly major upheaval within the firm, it is important for us all to concentrate on why we are here. While we are, of course, greatly saddened by the tragic loss of Herb Kovac, it is our clients who we are here to serve. It is they who pay our salaries, and we must not give them cause to look elsewhere for their investment advice. We need to conduct our personal affairs with the highest degree of probity and not give them any reason to doubt our honesty and integrity. I'm sure you will be asked by clients to speculate concerning the reason for Herb's untimely death, as well as on the nature of it, and on the other unfortunate events that occurred in these offices last Thursday. I ask that you refrain from any comments that may in any way place Lyle and Black in a bad light. If in doubt, please refer the clients to Mr. Gregory or myself." I assumed that the other unfortunate event referred to was my arrest. It made me wonder how Billy Searle was faring in hospital, and whether the police had made any progress in finding his attacker. Claudia's cancer revelation and her operation, coupled with the minor matter of finding an assassin on my doorstep, had kept my mind somewhat occupied elsewhere. I went onto the Racing Post website. "Billy Searle," it said, "was reported to be making steady progress. In fact, doctors at the Great Western Hospital in Swindon are amazed by the swiftness of his recovery from what were thought to be life-threatening injuries." I shouldn't really be surprised, I thought. Jump jockeys were made tough and a breed apart from normal human beings. Broken bones and concussion were accepted as normal hazards of their employment, to be endured and recovered from as quickly as possible. All jockeys were self-employed. No rides meant no pay. It was a powerful incentive for quick healing. There was nothing in the report about his attacker, other than the stated hope that Searle would soon be able to be interviewed by the detectives investigating the incident about the identity of his assailant. I wondered, meanwhile, if Billy was getting police protection. The night passed without incident, although I lay awake for much of it, half listening for someone climbing the drainpipe outside my bedroom window with gun in hand and murder in mind. I also spent the time thinking. In particular, I spent the time thinking about the note I had found in Herb's coat pocket. I knew the words of it by heart. "You should have done what you were told. You may say you regret it, but you won't be regretting it for long." I had told DCI Tomlinson that I thought it hadn't been so much a warning as an apology, even though he'd poo-pooed the idea. However, it did mean one thing for certain. Herb had known his killer, or at least he knew someone who knew he was going to die. That was assuming that the "won't be regretting it for long" did in fact refer to him dying soon. It could, I suppose, have been from a girlfriend who was dumping him for not doing as he was told, but somehow I doubted it. Notes from girlfriends are never written in stark capital letters without a salutation of some kind and a name. What had Herb been told to do that he hadn't done? Was it something to do with the gambling and the credit cards, or was there something else? I turned on the bedside light and wrote out the words in full on a notepad. "You should have done what you were told. You may say you regret it, but you won't be regretting it for long." I studied it carefully. Maybe Herb hadn't not done something that he'd been told to do. Perhaps he had done something that he'd been told not to. But to whom had he expressed regret for his inaction or action, and why had he regretted it? Because it had been wrong, or because it had placed him in danger? Still so many questions and still so few answers. "Leave the investigating to the professionals," the chief inspector had said to me, but how long would they take, and would I still be alive by then? Maybe it was time for me to start poking a few hornet's nests and hope not to get stung. I went into the hospital just after 7:30 on Wednesday morning. Claudia was so much improved, sitting up in her uncomfortable bed without as much as a murmur about backache, and she was eating a breakfast of muesli and natural yogurt. "Well, look at you," I said, smiling broadly. "You obviously had a better night than me." "Why, what was wrong with your night?" she asked. "Lumpy hotel bed," I said. "Why didn't you go home?" "Ah, I thought, careless. Now what do I say? I wanted to be nearer you, my darling.
But what a waste of money, she said with mock disapproval of my profligacy. If I have to stay in here another night, I insist you go home. I'll be fine.
Little did she know that there was no way I was going home, and neither was she. It was far too risky.
You look well enough to run a marathon, I said. I'm sure they'll chuck you out as soon as Mr. Tomic, Senior.
The nurse says he's usually here by 8. I looked up at the clock on the wall, the one that had driven me mad the previous day when Claudia had been in the operating theatre. It was 10 minutes before 8. As if on cue,